Palestinian resistance movement Hamas targets Tel Aviv with tens of missiles in response to Israel's attacks on the Ashanti refugee camp. A tower block housing the offices of several international news agencies in the Gaza Strip collapses after it was targeted by Israeli missiles. And more Iranian political figures, including Judiciary Chief Ayatollah Raisi, Vice President Eshaq Jahangiri, and former Parliament Speaker Ali Larijani, declare their bid for the presidency. And welcome to World News from our international headquarters right here in Tehran. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. Lots of news day. We're going to get right to it now, starting with the Palestinian resistance movement. Hamas says it has targeted Tel Aviv with tens of missiles in response to the regime's attack on the Al-Shati refugee camp. Israeli medics said one man was killed after a rocket ripped through the city of Ramat Gan near Tel Aviv. There's no report on the number of injuries yet. Hamas military wing Al-Qassam Brigades says it has also launched drone and mortar attacks on Israel's Kesufim military base. It says it is capable and prepared to bomb Tel Aviv for six straight months. Hamas has recently stepped up attacks on Israel in response to the regime's aggression on the besieged territory. Israel's Ramon Airport, as well as the cities of Ashkelon and Ashdod, have also come under missile attacks in the past few days. Meanwhile, Israel continues to pound the Gaza Strip using warplanes, navy boats, and artillery units, causing more death and destruction in the besieged Palestinian territory. A media tower has been flattened in the latest airstrikes. Now, the 13-story building housed international media offices as well as residential apartments. Israeli jets have also targeted the Al-Shati refugee camp in western Gaza, killing 10 Palestinians, all of them women and children. The head of the Hamas Political Bureau says the attack is indicative of the regime's helplessness in the face of Palestinians' resilience. Ismail Haniyeh stressed that Hamas would continue to defend the Palestinian nation against Israeli crimes. According to the Palestinian Health Ministry in Gaza, at least 139 people, including more than 60 women and children, have been killed. In the latest offensive, over 950 others have also been wounded. I'm crossed back over to Gaza City, joined again by Ashraf Shannon. Ashraf, thanks so much. I know you've been out there the whole day. Tell me about the overall vibe out there. I mean, you're standing right in front of rubble, one of the buildings or one of the towers that have been shot down. I mean, what are people saying when they're coming out on the streets and they're seeing this? Tell me the overall perspective of the people there on the Gaza Strip when dealing with this overall situation.
Marzia, when you talk to people who lost their homes or lost their businesses, they keep telling you it's a cheap price to pay for, it's a cheap price to pay for pride, for honor, the path to liberation. This is what almost everyone tells you. Although they are sad that they lost loved ones, they are sad that they lost their homes and businesses. But for Palestinians, especially in Gaza, the Israeli regime has been battering them for decades and pushed them to a point that they have nothing more to lose. And right now, resistance groups are retaliating to the recent bombing of the residential of that building, the 13-story building, and also retaliating to the crimes that the Israeli regime forces have been perpetrating since Monday. Scores of rockets are being fired even as we speak towards the Israeli regime, mainly targeting Tel Aviv and also Israeli areas close to the Gaza Strip. Since the beginning of this onslaught, the Israeli regime has killed at least 139 Palestinians in Gaza, including scores of women and children. The number is, I believe, is higher than 139, because the last time the Ministry of Health updated the number of fatalities and injuries was about 3 hours ago. So later in the day, they will update the numbers, and I believe the numbers will be much higher than 139. The overall spirits and the morale in Gaza is extremely high. People are proud of the Palestinian resistance. People are proud for the fact that the resistance groups this time are on the offensive, not only on the defenses. For years, Palestinians have been on the defensive, but the first time in their history, they've been really in the offensive against the Israeli occupiers of their land. In 1948, the Israeli regime was created on stolen Palestinian land. Same as today. Today is the anniversary of Palestinian Nakba Day, or the Palestinian catastrophe. So this is a very special day for Palestinians, especially when they see rockets flying towards the Israeli regime on this day, not only for avenging the killing of children and women in Gaza, but also you have to understand that this whole situation we're in right now that began on Monday is because of the Israeli violations and attacks on Muslim worshippers during the holy month of Ramadan inside the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound and inside the occupied city of Jerusalem Al-Quds.
Well, when you're talking to the people, do you get the feel that they think that there has been a transition? Because you said before it was always in defense, but this time around it's they've also been able to go on the offense. So do the people themselves feel like there has been a transition, that perhaps they see light at the end of the tunnel in order to basically get their land back?
Yes, Marzia. People, over the past few days, people have been feeling hope that they almost lost throughout the Israeli occupation and the Israeli wars. When they see Israeli soldiers targeted, Israeli security posts targeted, when they see, for example, Tel Aviv was Jaffa for Palestinians. Now it's called Tel Aviv. When they see that maybe this situation will lead them in one day will lead them to liberating Jaffa, and will be no more Tel Aviv, it's Jaffa for Palestinians. Currently, millions of Palestinians are displaced around the world, not only in Gaza. Gaza alone has more than 1.3 million Palestinian refugees out of the 2 million population, the second largest refugee population in West Asia.
Yeah, it's interesting. As you speak, Ashraf, people are walking regularly. I mean, it's as if that the people are so used to dealing with this type of pressure. It is absolutely amazing how they pick up with regular life in between these attacks. I mean, I think that says a lot about the resiliency of the Palestinian people.
Well, Marzi, yes. People here know that they have to remain strong, not only for them to continue living and aspire for tomorrow, but also for their children and grandchildren. This is why life continues despite the Israeli atrocities and acts that amounts to war crimes and crimes against humanity during their assault on Palestinians, not only in Gaza, but everywhere Palestinians are present.
And it's interesting the contrast, actually, Ashraf, because we've also seen footage of when the missiles, Hamas missiles and the resistance missiles have been hitting inside of Israel. As far as the reaction of the Israelis, and of course people are people as far as fear, but there seems to be a difference. There seems to be a certain type of determination when the same thing happens to Palestinians as opposed to extreme fear on the Israeli side. I don't know if you've seen that or your assessment of that.
Yes, Marzia. Israelis are not used to this because, as I said, this is the first time for them, for Palestinians to be on the offensive, basically. Palestinians, they've been used to the death and destruction and displacement for more than seven decades. Well, the Israelis, they occupied Palestinian land and have always been the victimizers. And this is why we see the contrast in when you compare Palestinians and the Israeli occupiers.
All right, thanks so much for that update. That's Ashraf Shanhan in Gaza City. Meanwhile, fresh rallies have been held in several countries in condemnation of Israel's deadly crackdown on Palestinian protesters in the West Bank and its aggression against Gaza. Thousands of people gathered in the Iraqi capital of Baghdad to hold rallies in solidarity for the Palestinian cause. They chanted slogans and condemned Israeli aggression against Palestinians. In Paris, France, many also gathered to show their support for Palestinians and condemn the Israeli attacks. They took to the streets despite a police ban on pro-Palestinian rallies. Thousands of people flooded the streets of London, marching in solidarity with Palestinians. They chanted Free Palestine and held banners calling for an end to the Israeli bombing of Palestinians. Cities around the world, including Caracas, Tunis, New York, and Sydney, also held rallies on Saturday. I'm going to cross over to Paris, where earlier we saw Chris Denhan out on the streets and, of course, police in mass and blocking protesters there. Let's cross back over and see what's going on. Chris, tell us what's happening.
Well, at the moment, the protesters are building up some small barricades made from market material, not really very heavy, and the police is constantly throwing tear gas. You see it behind me. And charging. So it's what is happening since 2 hours, like a cat and mouse game. But the protesters are really, they are always coming up. They are not giving away. Look, you can see here that they are gathering again behind, and then they go forward, and then they go back. Most of the people are very angry, of course, of the French authorities having banned this demonstration. They cannot understand that French political authorities ban a demonstration in solidarity of the Palestinian people. This has nothing to do with possible violence of the public order. I saw demonstrators around me. They are really very, they are angry, but they are not violent. They are not going to shout anti-Semitic slogans as what the French authorities have said before. This is an angry, normal demonstration, but the French authorities are not doing any concession to give these people some way to demonstrate. And I think that the police forces are using all the reserves, all the rest of their tear gas, because it's really lots of tear gas they are using. Every moment when the demonstrators are moving forward, then the police is throwing tear gas with a water cannon. Some people are throwing stones, so the tear gas will come very soon, as usual.
Yes, of course, we saw earlier the tear gas, the water cannons, and it's interesting that people, despite this, they actually refuse to go home and continue to try to regroup. I guess that was tear gas canisters being fired, I'm assuming.
And sound bombs, yes, I show the tear gas behind. Look at the tear gas behind. And the police behind, they're charging now. They are coming. There they are. And the water cannon is coming. This is going on for hours this way. I mean, it would be easy for the French authorities to authorize a kind of demonstration, and they did not do this. Nobody understands really the reason why the French government has banned this demonstration, because elsewhere than Paris, in Marseille, in Lyon, the demonstrations were very very massive, very peaceful, very determined. And here in Paris, it's banned.
I mean, I guess someone would say, as you said, it would have been easier for them just to allow the demonstration. What is the French government afraid of? Why won't they allow French people to demonstrate against Israel?
Well, they are afraid of the popular suburb, that's for sure. If it's white French, there's not so many problems. If it's people from the suburb, they are afraid from the popular people of the suburb. Not that they are creating more troubles than other people during a first May demonstration, absolutely not. But it's a kind of racist behavior from the French government and the French authorities towards these people from the suburb, or not from the suburb. Many people, they live here in the northeast of Paris. It's still the more popular neighborhood. So it's a really, I think, I'm not sure about this, but it's a calculation of the French government to win the elections in one year against the far right of Marine Le Pen. But it's a very, very risky calculation, because at the same time, all the political authorities are losing the support of the young people.
All right, thanks so much, Chris. Of course, I'll be checking back with you at the streets of Paris. That's our correspondent, Chris Dehaene, in Paris. Well, the fifth and final day of registration of potential candidates for an upcoming presidential election in Iran is underway. Two members of the expediency council, Saeed Jalili and Mohsen Rezaei, have registered. Earlier in the day, Judiciary Chief Ayatollah Ibrahim Raisi also officially declared his bid for the presidency by turning up at headquarters on the Interior Ministry in the capital, Tehran. Other notable figures who registered today include Vice President Eshaq Jahangiri, former Parliament Speaker Ali Larijani, former IRIB Chief Ezatollah Zarqami, and the Chairman of Tehran City Council, Mohsen Hashemi. Other high-profile hopefuls have also filed their nomination papers over the past few days. Among them were ex-President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad and former ministers Rostam Qasemi and Hossein Dehghan. The candidates have to wait for final approval from the Constitutional Council. Iran's presidential election is slated for June the 18th. And with that brings us to the end of this World News Edition. Thanks so much for staying tuned.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio. In the limelight.
Many Palestinians have been kicked out of their neighborhoods and replaced by Israeli settlers, says Yanis Sirban, writer in an article titled Ethnic Cleansing of Sheikh Jarrah. Stay tuned for more. In 1983, Rafael Itan, chief of the staff of Israeli Defense Forces, IDF, said, "When we have settled the land, all the Arabs will be able to do about it will be too scary around." Today, we are seeing such attempts by dehumanization in Sheikh Jarrah, an area of occupied and illegally annexed East Al-Quds. Beginning from May 2nd, 2021, The Zionist regime has begun its attempts to forcibly evict 26 Palestinian families from their homes in Sheikh Jarrah. These families consist of refugees since the Nakba, the 1947-49 expulsion and forced exile of over two-thirds of population by Zionist forces, and have been denied their United Nations mandated right to return home. They were relocated in a neighborhood when it was under Jordanian control between 1948 and 1967. The Zionist regime propaganda attempts to present the idea that the homes being seized were once owned by the Jews. This is a complete lie. The Jordanian authorities were the ones to finance the construction of the homes. Since the early 1970s, Palestinians in Sheikh Jarrah have been battling a series of Jewish settler organizations who filed lawsuits claiming the land belonged to them. Many Palestinians have been kicked out of the neighborhoods and replaced by Israeli settlers. The current standoff and protest came about after an Israeli court ruled in favor of Nahalat Shimon International, an organization based in the U.S., and Atrat Kohanim, another settlement group that seeks to take over the properties. In its bloody quest to eliminate Palestinians from Sheikh Jarrah, the settler state has left no stone unturned. Combat-clad murderers have been sent to terrorize Palestinian sit-ins with skunk water, tear gas, rubber-coated bullets, and shock grenades. Protesters have been physically assaulted, kneeled on, choked, and shot with live rounds. On May 7, 2021, the Israeli regime police forced its way into the neighborhood as Palestinians and solidarity activists gathered to break their Ramadan fasting in solidarity with 40 Palestinians, including 10 children. As Palestinians gathered to demonstrate against the forceful eviction of dozens of residents, Jewish settlers, including Itamar Ben-Gvir, a lawmaker and a follower of Mayor Kahane, founder of the Violent Jewish Defense League, who advocated the mass ethnic cleansing of Palestinians, arrived at the scene. Ben-Gvir set up a provisional office across the street from the iftar meal, as other settlers who have chanted racist slogans such as "Death to Arabs" and called for all Palestinians to be thrown out from their neighborhoods, pepper sprayed at the iftar table. On the same day, a video surfaced on social media which showed Ben-Gvir along with Al-Quds deputy mayor Arya King disparagingly yelling at a Palestinian who was apparently wounded by Israeli regime police, yet returned to protest against the evictions of a Palestinian family. Ben-Gvir is heard shouting, "The bullet is still there, that's why he is limping." The deputy mayor King is also seen explaining to Ben-Gvir. Then King himself joins the shouting. "Did they take the bullet out of their bodies? Did they take it out already? It is a pity it did not go in their body," he continues, referring to the bullet while pointing to his head. It is not surprising that King used this sadistic rhetoric. He is the director of a right-wing settler organization named Israel Land Fund, or ILF, which constantly targets the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood. In 2017, King told an Israeli newspaper that up to 500 Israeli families would move into Sheikh Jarrah within the next decade. The price method of doing this has been made clear now, namely Zionist terrorism. The colonialist attempts of the Zionist regime to evict Palestinians from Sheikh Jarrah are patently illegal. The Palestinians consider East Al-Quds to be their capital, as does most of the planet. The Zionist regime captured East Al-Quds during the Six-Day War in 1967. In the immediate aftermath of the war, it passed the Municipalities Ordinance Amendment No. 6 law, which authorized extension of the Israeli regime law and administration to East Al-Quds and empowered the Interior Ministry to unilaterally enlarge the municipal boundaries of East Al-Quds. In 1980, the Israeli regime illegally annexed East Al-Quds as part of the Basic Law of Al-Quds, which declared that Al-Quds, complete and united, is the capital of Israel, they claimed. To cement the annexation, the Zionist regime approved the Master Plan 2000, a massive scheme to rearrange the boundaries of the city in such a way that it would ensure permanent demographic majority for Israeli Jews at the expense of the city's native inhabitants. In other words, the master plan was a blueprint for a state-sponsored ethnic cleansing campaign, which saw the destruction of thousands of Palestinian homes and the subsequent eviction of numerous families. In response to the 1967 Act, the United Nations Security Council, UNSC, adopted Resolution 252, which affirmed that acquisition of territory by military conquest is inadmissible. The resolution also stated all legislative and administrative measures and actions taken by Israel, including expropriation of land and properties thereon, which tend to change the legal status of Al-Quds, are invalid and cannot change that status. This view has been reiterated with regard to the ethnic cleansing of Sheikh Jarrah. We call on Israel to immediately call off all forced evictions, UN Rights Office spokesman Robert Colville told reporters in Geneva on May 7, 2021. He emphasized that East Al-Quds remains part of the occupied Palestinian territory in which international humanitarian law applies and that Israel is not authorized to impose its own set of laws in occupied territory, including East Al-Quds. The occupying power cannot confiscate private property in occupied territory. Under international law, he said, it is illegal to transfer civilian populations into occupied territory, and this may amount to war crimes. Colville urged the Zionist regime to depart from behavior that further contributes to a coercive environment or leads to a risk of forcible transfer. We further call on Israel to respect freedom of expression and assembly, including with those who are protesting against evictions, and to exercise maximum restraint in the use of force and code. In today's world, the settler colonial logic of ideological obliteration has been aided by social media giants. These platforms have again displayed their quasi relations with the Zionist regime colonialism by censoring, limiting, or shutting down the accounts of those users who have uploaded and shared video content and images about the Zionist regime attacks in Sheikh Jarrah. This wide-ranging campaign to erasure will come to an end only if the world univocally opposes the annihilationist and annexationist agenda of the fake regime of Israel.
Africa Today.
The people of Nigeria are paying a deadly price for importing Europe's dirty fuel. The government of this most populous country in Africa has failed to stop the importation of these toxic heavy fuel manufactured in Europe. Tens of thousands of Nigerians die every year due to pollution, and now the masses are saying enough is enough. Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a warm welcome to this week's edition of Africa Today. We are going to focus on how Nigeria is importing dirty fuel from Europe. This fuel is having devastating effects on the health of Nigerians and the country's environment. In the second segment of our program, we're going to talk about the ongoing conflict over Ethiopia's massive hydroelectric dam being built on the Nile River. This project is opposed by Egypt and Sudan. Egypt's President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi recently warned Ethiopia of risk of conflict over its giant dam.
I am telling our brothers in Ethiopia, let's not reach a point where you touch a drop of water from Egypt. Because all options are open.
Join us till the end of our show as our experts analyze these issues.
Europe selling dirty oil to Nigeria. The Nigerian government has since 2016 been making repeated promises to end the importation of dirty fuel from Europe. Members of the Economic Community of West African States, ECOWAS, convened a two-day workshop in Abuja in June 2016 with the plan to end the use of dirty European fuels in their countries. According to a non-governmental organization known as the Stakeholder Democracy Network, Nigeria is plagued with some of the worst air pollution levels on the planet. In a report, this NGO noted that apart from damaging vehicle engines, the dirty fuel is having a detrimental impact on public health and national air quality. A Nigerian affected by pollution emanating from this dirty fuel speaks out here.
You wake up in the morning to black particles surrounding us and making us unhealthy.
For more on this subject, we have contacted Jesse Martin Manfur, a senior project officer for the Stakeholder Democracy Network, SDN. He was involved in SDN's research on toxic fuel. Thanks a lot for your time, sir.
Thank you for having me.
Now, it's quite surprising to many that Nigeria, an oil-rich country, imports dirty fuel from Europe. What's the reason for this, Manfur?
It's surprising. Nigeria exports sweet, slow sulfur fuel and, you know, gets in exchange of imports of highly sulfurous fuel. The reason is not far-fetched. The refineries Nigeria have are unable to produce enough fuel for the domestic consumption of Nigerians. So to subsist for this, the government has no option than to import fuel to augment whatever that is produced within the country. So that has resulted in this this situation whereby a large bulk of the fuel that is being consumed in Nigeria is either imported from Europe or the ones that are artisanally refined within the country, which the government still term as illegal.
According to some estimates, Nigeria imports approximately 900,000 tons a year of low-quality, toxic heavy fuel manufactured in Europe. According to some reports, the fuel being refined illegally in the bushes of Niger Delta is of a higher quality than the petrol imported into Nigeria from European countries. Now, why has the Nigerian government failed to fulfill its promise of ending the importation of dirty fuels from Europe?
It all has to do with structural, because Nigeria at the moment has four government-run refineries, but they are poorly maintained. The government has put in a lot of money in towards the maintenance of these refineries. But what has happened is that it turns out to be a corruption-laden process where money is pumped into the refineries and they never get to produce anything. So that has hindered the ability of the Nigerian government to be able to stop the importation of dirty fuel. Currently now, the government is relying on a new refinery that's being built by Dangote Refineries, one of the richest men in Nigeria, to produce most of the domestic consumption of fuel in the country.
Thanks for your insight, Mr. Manfur, and stay tuned for more.
The European Union says it has adopted ambitious new targets to curb climate change.
However, in a clear case of double standards, low-grade diesel imported from Europe to Nigeria exceeds daily EU pollution limits by up to 204 times. For petrol, the pollution emissions are around 43 times higher than legal EU levels. David Ovalar, the executive director of Africa Network for the Environment and Economic Justice, has been leading a campaign to stop the importation of dirty fuel from Europe to Nigeria.
The Swiss trading companies and other companies that are importing dirty fuel into Nigeria need to know that they do have a corporate social responsibility that is expected from them, that they should help to bring clean fuel to Nigeria.
Now, Nigeria is among many African countries still using dangerous, low-grade, high-sulfur fuels, which have long been banned in Western countries. So why are European countries dumping this dirty fuel in Africa?
I think it's cheaper for, you know, the process of refining fuel to remove the huge sulfur, you know, it's more costly when compared to, you know, exporting it as feed. And markets such as, unregulated markets such as Nigeria and the West African sub-region leaves open the opportunity for people to, you know, sharp business practices to send this thing to unregulated markets such as that in West Africa. So it's left for Nigerian governments to make sure that they tighten the standards that they have within the country. Then they will now be able to enforce and ensure that only quality fuel that meets their standards can come into the country. Otherwise, businesses who are looking for ways to maximize profit will always find ways to bring this sulfur-laden fuel into the country.
Clearly, it's up to the Nigerian government to stop these unscrupulous European oil companies from dumping their dirty oil in Africa.
Nigeria now has some of the world's most polluted cities, and this is partly due to the use of these dirty fuels from Europe. This dirty fuel is a major contributor to Nigeria's public health crisis, with the latest data suggesting around 114,000 people die due to air pollution-related causes every year. In Lagos, a World Bank study estimates air pollution resulted in 11,200 premature deaths in 2018 alone.
Now, Mr. Manfu, how is this dirty fuel from Europe impacting on the health of the people of Nigeria and the country's environment?
It has huge environmental and health impacts. For instance, the city of Port Harcourt, where I live, since 2016, have been suffering from what we term black soot, where particulate matter, you know, keeps in the air and goes into the lungs and nostrils of individuals. So we've witnessed cases of increased respiratory-related diseases, asthma, bronchitis, and all that. And this has a huge impact on the healthcare burden in the states. You know, it costs people a lot more to take care of their health. On the environmental part, we have issues of, due to air pollution, we have acid rain, which makes the environment unpalatable for people to live in, affecting, having impacts on the quality of the building materials that we use in building our homes, on farming and the quality of produce that can be produced from the land, which has become infertile from acid rain.
Well, in a move towards self-reliance in fuel production, Nigeria's Minister of State for Petroleum Resources recently said the government has embarked on the modernization of some of the country's refineries.
And you can see the milestone that we achieved last week. The Federal Executive Council has already approved the rehabilitation, comprehensive rehabilitation of Port Harcourt refineries, and we are on course to rehabilitate Warri and Kaduna refinery.
Now, Mr. Manful, do you expect the situation to improve in the near future?
I'll say yes. Two things and two reasons for that is, first, the ECOWAS sub-region is working with United Nations Environment Program is trying to push for the adoption of a standard for fuel use within the sub-region. So if this is adopted and member countries begin to enforce them, including my country, Nigeria, then we'll be able to make sure that only quality fuel can be imported into the country if we still need to import fuel. And that way, we'll reduce the amount of sulfur in our fuels that we use in the country. Another thing is what the government is doing now with although it's a reliance on a private refinery, which has about 600,000 barrels per day capacity, which will be able to provide enough fuel for the domestic Nigerian market. And as it does done, Nigeria does not have any need to import sulfur laden fuel into it, because already the country has very low sulfur content crude oil within the country. So we'll be able to solve that problem in the medium to long term.
While clearly the rehabilitation of Nigerian oil refineries will meet the country's domestic demand for clean fuels and curb its reliance on imports. Now we're going for a short break, and when we come back, we'll talk about the conflict over Ethiopia's giant dam on the Nile. Stay with us.
Missions of my life today. We are always walking through this door, but today we are cut off from access to our farm, and our worker needs food, so we gotta walk through the door to cross to get to our farm
to deliver some groceries.
Man, always random things going on. So this is our Ramadan routine. Take you guys through a day in our life of what it's like Ramadan in the motherland. But first things first, we gotta go feed our amazing staff at the farm.
Deadlock over Ethiopia's dam.
Egypt and Sudan failed to reach an agreement at the last round of talks with Ethiopia over the Grand Ethiopian Renaissance Dam. Now, the talks were held in the Democratic Republic of Congo's capital, Kinshasa, early April. This latest round of talks was hosted by Congolese President Felix Tshisekedi, who is also the current chairperson of the African Union. Now, Sudan's Foreign Minister, Mariam Assadiq El-Mahdi, told reporters that Ethiopia's insistence on unilateral moves represents a violation of international law.
Ethiopia issued a statement accusing Egypt and Sudan of pursuing an approach that seeks to undermine the AU-led process and to take the matter out of the African platform. Sudan and Egypt have refused to take part in the Nile Basin Comprehensive Framework Agreement unless Ethiopia recognizes their right to oversee the use of most of the Nile waters, which a British colonial treaty of 1959 accorded to them. This treaty is also contested by other Nile Basin countries. The multi-billion dollar Grand Ethiopian Renaissance Dam has been a source of tension in the Nile River Basin ever since Ethiopia started its construction in 2011.
Now, for more on the protracted conflict of the Grand Ethiopian Renaissance Dam, we have contacted Dr. Ashok Twain, a professor of peace and conflict research and UNESCO chair of international water cooperation at Uppsala University. Thanks a lot for your time, Dr. Swain.
My pleasure.
Now, what is the current state of dialogue between Ethiopia, Egypt, and Sudan over the Grand Ethiopian Renaissance Dam?
So, three countries have been negotiating to find an agreement of how to fill the reservoirs. This is a big dam, very big dam, how to fill the reservoirs and how to coordinate among themselves. Now for almost more than 1.5 years. And this negotiation has come to a standstill after it failed to get a deal through African Union-led negotiation, which was being chaired by Congo a couple of weeks ago.
Thanks for that insight, Dr. Swain, and we'll be right back.
The filling of the dam's massive reservoir is expected to commence during the upcoming rainy season, which normally begins in June or July. Despite opposition by Sudan and Egypt, Ethiopia's water minister, Seleshi Bekele, recently said his country will continue to fill a mega dam on the Nile River.
On second year filling, also it's very clear it has nothing to do with anything. As construction progresses, filling takes place. This is our commonly agreed declaration of principle. We don't deviate from that at all.
What are the major points of disagreements between the parties to the conflict?
The immediate disagreement or what is going on that for the last several months is whether the agreement will be a binding one or it will be just a memorandum of understanding. Ethiopia is refusing to make this agreement legally binding because I think the real reason, as I understand, is Ethiopia is fearing that if it gets into a legally binding agreement, it might not be able to develop the water resources in the future.
Internationally, the European Union says it supports the African Union in the quest for a negotiated solution on the Grand Ethiopian Renaissance Dam. The United States also recently appointed veteran diplomat Jeffrey Feltman as a special envoy for the Horn of Africa. He is expected to join European powers involved in talks with the three countries.
However, Ethiopian Foreign Minister Demeke Mekonnen has expressed his country's categorical rejection of any attempt to force Addis Ababa to accept a colonial agreement with Egypt and Sudan regarding the Renaissance Dam. Mekonnen says exerting unnecessary pressures on Ethiopia by deliberately politicizing and internationalizing the dam dispute will not force his country to accept an agreement dating back to the colonial era. Now, Dr. Swain, do we expect an expanded involvement of international powers in trying to resolve the conflict?
This African Union-led negotiation, and Sudan has been asking for the involvement of US, UN, and EU, and so Egypt is supporting it, but Ethiopia has been opposing it.
Egyptian President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi, a major US ally in the region, warned of the risk of a military conflict over Ethiopia's giant dam on the Blue Nile after talks ended without progress.
I am telling our brothers in Ethiopia, let's not reach a point where you touch a drop of water from Egypt. Because all options are open.
Ethiopian Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed has said his country doesn't have any intention to cause harm to Sudan and Egypt. But he added that Ethiopians don't want to live in darkness. Both sides are clearly sticking to their guns. Are there chances that the disagreements over the dam will lead to a regional military conflict, or diplomacy will prevail?
You know, the threat to any Ethiopian use of water on the upstream have been very regularly being threatened by Egypt before. the one of the good things Ethiopia had done before, when it started building this hydropower dam, that it had brought Sudan to its side. But what had happened for the last several months, that the conflict between Ethiopia and Sudan has pushed Sudan towards the Egyptian side. So Egypt and Sudan coming together, and I think there has been a number of threats have been issued, particularly after the failure of the talk in Kinshasa. So, but the question is whether it will lead to military conflict or not. I do expect that it should not. It hasn't, because the countries have not fought over the water till now, and I think it will be a huge problem, or particularly for the countries to develop the water resources further if they get engaged in military conflict. But considering the situation in the region, you can never rule out anything.
There have been reports indicating that the Israeli regime military has installed the Spider-MR air defense system for the Great Ethiopian Renaissance Dam amid the ongoing dispute. Israeli regime's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu visited Addis Ababa in 2016 and said the Tel Aviv regime will assist Ethiopia in benefiting from its water resources.
The Grand Ethiopian Renaissance Dam will be Africa's largest hydroelectric power project once fully operational. It will produce 6,000 megawatts of electricity, twice as much as Ethiopia's entire current output. Now, the dam is expected to give the region a major economic boost. Dr. Swain, how will the Grand Renaissance Dam impact on Ethiopia's economy and the region in general?
It's a massive dam, almost $5 billion dam. It's a hydropower dam, as I said before. It will produce huge amount of hydropower, which Ethiopia is in the urgent need, because Ethiopia is population is growing, Ethiopia's economy has been on the upswing for some years, so it needs hydropower. But I think it will also produce a lot of hydropower. Even Ethiopia can sell in cheaper way energy to Sudan, and even also Egypt can benefit. We must know that the Grand Renaissance Dam is a hydropower dam, so the water is not going anywhere. So it just need to that these three countries need to develop the trust and trust each other how to cooperate on that dam.
Dr. Ashok Bia says that trust is key in solving the conflict between Ethiopia, Egypt and Sudan over the Grand Renaissance Dam. Now here at Africa Today, we shall keep you posted as the conflict evolves. So let us know what you think these three African countries should do to solve this conflict. And that wraps it up for this week's edition of Africa Today. Goodbye for now.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Badr 5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en, And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.